How is it that some people can face all that is wrong with the world and all that is destroyed by evil and still remain hopeful? How does a person decide to hold on to sacred values even when that act puts their life at risk? How did a little boy born in a small Bohemian village become a Unitarian martyr, a man whose name is spoken in the same breath as Jan Hus, Michael Servetus, James Reeb? When Norbert Chopek was 12 years old, he was sent to live with his uncle because his parents couldn't afford to keep him. During the day, he was a tailor's apprentice. At night, he was an avid reader and thinker. He was especially interested in religion and constantly questioned what it meant to be Catholic. All that questioning eventually led him away from the state-sponsored Roman Catholic Church, and at the age of 18, he became a Baptist. His uncle saw this as a great act of disrespect and kicked him out of the house. The Baptists, on the other hand, happily took him in, and sensing that Chopek was a natural preacher, sent him to seminary. As a young man, Chopek sold Bibles door to door and started almost a dozen churches from the Ukraine to Budapest. Along the way, he learned about the native religion of his people. Liberal Christianity had been practiced in Bohemia from as early as 1404. He learned of a community there called the Brothers and Sisters of the Free Spirit. They rejected the Trinity. They believed that the inner light was more important than the letter of the Bible, and they believed most of all in the spiritual life. Chopek also added to his sources of inspiration the American Social Gospel Movement and American Unitarianism. Now, growing up Catholic, Chopek had never heard these ideas before, and he quickly latched on to these new ways of thinking, and he came to believe that religion really ought to apply to the real lives of people. Eventually, his thinking became more and more liberal. He decided to leave Bohemia to serve a Baptist church in New York. Maya Jakovec, also from Bohemia, arrived in New York about 7 years earlier. Now, she was also one of those children who questioned the faith of her fathers and mothers. She enrolled at Columbia University in 1907 to study library science. In 1914, the same year that Chopek arrived, she was put in charge of the Czechoslovak department of the New York Public Library. And that's where they met, and they were soon married. A year later, Chopek's persistent liberal leanings got him into big trouble. He was put on trial for heresy in front of the Baptist tribunal. And even though he was acquitted, this was the beginning of the end of his career as a Baptist minister. 4 years later, he left. In his diary, he wrote, "I cannot be a Baptist anymore, even in compromise. The fire of new desire, new worlds, is burning inside me." Chopek sent his wife and two daughters out into the New Jersey suburbs to find a new church home. They came back with great enthusiasm about the liberal religious education program they found at the Unitarian Church in Orange, New Jersey. The Chopeks signed the book and became members of that congregation. Their minister introduced Chopek to the then president of the American Unitarian Association, Samuel Atkins Elliott. And Chopek convinced the association to help him start a Unitarian church in the newly liberated country of Czechoslovakia. In 1921, Norbert and Maya Chopek, along with their daughter and her husband, moved back to Prague to build a nationwide religious movement. Because their new congregation had rejected Catholicism, the new church avoided all singing, all prayers, and all rituals. And instead of passing the collection plate, members paid an admission fee at the door. But after a year or two, Chapek wanted to add a spiritual and experiential element to the service that would move people beyond the spoken word of the sermon. And that's how he came to create the Flower Communion. For 20 years, constrained by neither government, nor Pope, nor Baptists, Chapek preached from a free pulpit. Every person, he declared, is an embodiment of God, and the deepest human desire is for communion with the infinite. The church's task, then, must be to place truth above any tradition, spirit above any scripture, and freedom above authority. For 20 years, the people came in droves to hear these words. The Unitarian Church in Prague grew to be the largest Unitarian congregation in the world, with over 3,200 members. Then, in 1939, the Czech regions of Bohemia and Moravia became protectorates of the Third Reich, and its citizens once again lost their independence. The Gestapo targeted Czech politicians and intelligentsia. Given the wide and inquiring reach of Chapek's ministry, it was not surprising that the Gestapo was watching him very closely. Knowing this, he and his congregation supported one another by quietly keeping hope alive in subversive ways. They had all created a symbol for their church. It was a big U, kind of in the form of a chalice, with two sunny flowers coming out of it. And underneath was the Czech slogan that said, truth prevails, and it was written in Latin. Now, during the Nazi occupation, those words were forbidden, and so the church changed the words to Pravda Viteji. The Nazis never discovered that those Czech words mean exactly the same thing, truth prevails. In his sermons, Chapek would use metaphorical language to predict the eventual downfall of the Nazi regime. He would say things like, "No matter how cold the winter, no matter how long, spring will always come." On March 28, 1941, Chapek and his youngest daughter, Nora, were arrested for listening to enemy broadcasts and for distributing the content of BBC transmissions, a capital offense. The courts ruled in the Chapek's favor, granting leniency for his age. But the Gestapo ignored the court's recommendations, sending Zora to forced labor in Germany and Chapek to Dachau. The exact circumstances of his death are not known, but it seems that he was killed either by poison gas or lethal injection on October 12, 1942. He was 72 years old. Life here in Williamsburg in 2007 couldn't be more different from Prague in 1942. And yet, in this media-saturated culture, we are constantly brought face to face with the manifestations of evil from every corner of the world. The litany of genocide, oppression, and injustice is too familiar to bear repeating. What then is to be our response to the persistence of cruelty and malevolence? Shall we turn off the TV? Stop getting the paper? Shall we retreat to our gardens and our travels and our friends? Shall we turn away from all unpleasantness and greet only that which is beautiful, that which we have in such abundance where we live. Last week, I was listening to an interview with the playwright Eve Ensler, and she was talking about this very situation in her own life. Ensler is the creator of the Vagina Monologues and has committed her entire life to ending violence against women. She describes her pre-activist days in this way. She said that she had turned away from all of the cruelties of the world. For most of her life, she said, almost all of her consciousness was closed off to what was happening to the vulnerable and to the oppressed. But instead of finding relief and solace and protection in that insulated state, she found herself closed off and actually diminished in her vitality and love for life. She said that her life felt meaningless and sad. She felt disconnected. We know that this would be the same for us if we chose to turn away from the suffering of the world. Because, as Chapek said, it is worthwhile to live and fight courageously for sacred ideals. Oh, blow ye evil winds into my body's fire, my soul you'll never unravel. Even though disappointed 1,000 times or fallen in the fight and everything would seem worthless, I have lived amidst eternity. Be grateful, my soul, my life was worth living. Chapek wrote these words while imprisoned in Dachau. We know we have to face the real presence of evil among us, but how? How do we do that without plunging into despair? How do we do that without losing heart? One important way is by remembering who we are. By remembering that the human spirit cannot be extinguished, even in the midst of death and devastation. Norbert Chapek did not possess supernatural abilities. He was a flawed human being, just like you, just like me. And yet, he seemed to be more in touch with that inextinguishable human spirit than most people. We can hear that spirit in Chapek's written words, words that echo a basic Unitarian tenet first expressed by William Ellery Channing. He writes, "I always start from the consciousness that I am eternal. What is highest in me is godly, and I am given the creative powers to be able to cope with and reshape every life, every situation, every pain, every disappointment, every setback. If we know that we are eternal, we cannot lose anything, but only gain and once more gain." So what kind of practice will help us to remember these important truths about ourselves? Truths to which Chapek was so powerfully connected. It is the practice of coming together with others, seeking to recover the same memories, retelling the same stories, singing the familiar songs, celebrating heroes, and reenacting the rituals in which the symbols of our heritage and our essential humanity are displayed. What I am describing here is communion. Now, Christians do this by the Eucharist. By sharing bread and wine, they remember the life of Jesus. "Do this in memory of me," he told his followers on the eve of his death. Despite centuries of persecution and violent oppression, those early Christian communities remembered who they were by repeating the Holy Communion. The Eucharist is not our ritual. but the flower communion is. And for me, this communion is not a hollow exercise to fill the spaces at the end of a worship calendar. It is not merely a springtime celebration of gardening. It is a ritual. It binds intention with action, mind with body. And as a communal ritual, it binds us one to another. As a practice with a specific origin, it binds us to the story of Norbert Čapek, the Unitarian Church of Prague, and our distinguished tradition of honoring dissent and truth. We use flowers, not berries, not vegetables, because that's what Čapek used. And you know, there's something evocative about doing a thing the same way over and over again. In our times of trouble, this tradition can be very consoling to us. Flowers come in such a diverse array, just like people. And when you put them together in a bouquet, the whole arrangement is lovelier than each individual flower. There is a deeper meaning to the flower, more than just its beauty. Flowers are the tangible objects. They are the proof of an invisible, indomitable spirit of life. No matter how cold the winter, no matter how long, the spring will always come. On May 18th, 1980, Mount St. Helens erupted. An ash-filled plume rose 15 miles into the air, and within 3 minutes, 230 square miles of land and timber were destroyed. Yet just a few months later, a wildflower known as the willow herb, the fireweed, emerged from the ashes. That's the flower depicted on your order of service. The fireweed attracts new life into a place that appears to be hopelessly uninhabitable. Bees and spiders and hawks and songbirds all came, and the elk soon followed because apparently they love the taste of the fireweed blossoms. The fireweed is a compelling symbol of the heroic resiliency of life. Heroism comes from the audacity to persevere when it just seems utterly hopeless, and to sustain hope when it seems utterly lifeless. Norbert Čapek answered this audacious call, and so can we as a community of memory and hope. For what are we in this world to do, if not to be on the hopeful side of remembrance rather than the despairing side of forgetfulness? May it be so.